eye on the pity of doormen.
"I wouldn't have gone up," said Bristow, miserably, blotches of colour dappling his thin neck again. "But I had the contract with Sir May to give back to her. She'd asked me to look over it, and she needed to sign it. She could be quite blasé about things like that. Anyway, she wasn't too happy that they'd let me upstairs, and we rowed again. But it burned itself out quite quickly. She calmed down. So then I told her that Mum would appreciate a visit. Mum had just got out of hospital, you see. She'd had a hysterectomy. Lula said she might pop in and see her later at her flat, but that she couldn't be sure. She had things on." Bristow took a deep breath. His right knee started jiggling up and down again, and his knobble-knuckled hands washed each other in dumb show. "I don't want you to think badly of her. People thought her selfish, but she'd been the youngest in the family and rather indulged. And then she was ill and, naturally, the centre of attention. And then she was plunged into this extraordinary life where things, people, revolved around her, and she was pursued everywhere by the paparazzi. It wasn't a normal existence."
"No," said Strike.
"So, anyway, I told Lula how groggy and sore Mum was feeling, and she said she might look in on her later. I left. I nipped into my office to get some files from Allison, because I wanted to work from Mum's flat that day and keep her company. I next saw Lula at Mum's, mid-morning. She sat with Mum for a while in the bedroom until my uncle arrived to visit, and then nipped into the study where I was working to say goodbye. She hugged me before she—"
Bristow's voice cracked, and he stared down into his lap. "More coffee?" Strike suggested.
Bristow shook his bowed head.
To give him a moment to pull himself together, Strike picked up the tray and headed for the outer office.
Bristow's girlfriend looked up from her newspaper, scowling when Strike appeared.
"Aren't you finished?" she asked.
"Evidently not," said Strike, with no attempt at a smile.
She glared at him while he addressed Robin.
"Could I get another cup of coffee,
Robin stood up and took the tray from him in silence. "John needs to be back at the office at 10:30, Allison informed Strike, in a slightly louder voice. "We'll need to be off in 10 minutes at the most."
"I'll bear that in mind," Strike assured her blandly,
before returning to the inner office, where Bristow was sitting as though in prayer, his head bowed over his clasped hands.
"I'm sorry," he muttered,
as Strike sat back down.
"It's still difficult talking about it."
"No problem," said Strike, picking up his notebook again. "So, Lula came to see your mother. What time was that?"
11-ish. It all came out at the inquest, what she did after that. She got her driver to take her to some boutique that she liked, and then she went back to her flat. She had an appointment at home with a makeup artist she knew, and her friend, Kiara Porter, joined her there. You'll have seen Kiara Porter, she's a model. Very blonde. They were photographed together as angels, you probably saw it. Naked except for handbags and wings. Sir May used the picture in his advertising campaign after Lula died. People said it was tasteless. So Lula and Kiara spent the afternoon together at Lula's flat, and then they left to go out to dinner, where they met up with Duffield and some other people. The whole group went on to Uzi, the nightclub, and they were there until past midnight. Then Duffield and Lula argued. Lots of people saw it happen. He manhandled her a bit, tried to make her stay, but she left the club alone. Everyone thought he'd done it afterwards, but he turned out to have a cast-iron alibi.
"Cleared on the evidence of his drug dealer, wasn't he?" asked Strike, still writing.
"Yes, exactly. So Lula arrived back at her flat around 1:20. She was photographed going inside. You probably remember that picture. It was everywhere afterwards."
Strike remembered. One of the world's most photographed women, head bowed, shoulders hunched, eyes heavy and arms folded tightly around her torso, twisting her face away from the photographers. Once the verdict of suicide had been clearly established, it had taken on a macabre aspect.
the rich and beautiful young woman, less than an hour from her death, attempting to conceal her wretchedness from the lenses she had courted and which had so adored her.
Were they usually photographers outside her door?
Yes, especially if they knew she was with Duffield, or they wanted to get a shot of her coming home drunk. But they weren't only there for her that night. An American rapper was supposed to be arriving to stay in the same building that evening. D.B. Max, his name. His record company had rented the apartment beneath hers. In the event, he never stayed there, because with the police all over the building, it was easier for him to go to a hotel. But the photographers who would chase Lula's car when she left Uzi joined the ones who were waiting for Mac outside the flats, so that made quite a crowd of them around the entrance of the building, though they all drifted away not long after she'd gone inside. Somehow they got a tip-off that Mac wouldn't be there for hours. It was a bitterly cold night, snowing, below freezing, so the street was empty when she fell. Bristow blinked and took another sip of cold coffee, and Strike thought about the paparazzi who had left before Lula Landry fell from her balcony. Imagine, he thought, what a shot of Landry diving to her death would have gone for. Enough to retire on, perhaps.
John, your girlfriend says you need to be somewhere at 10:30.
What? Bristow seemed to return to himself. He checked the expensive watch and gasped. Good God, I had no idea I'd been here so long. What happens now? He asked, looking slightly bewildered. You'll read my notes?
Yes, of course, Strike assured him. And I'll call you in a couple of days when I've done some preliminary work. I expect I'll have a lot more questions then.
All right, said Bristow, getting dazedly to his feet. Here, take my card. And how would you like me to pay?
A month's fee in advance will be great, said Strike.
Quashing feeble stirrings of shame, and remembering that Bristow himself had offered a double fee, he named an exorbitant amount, and to his delight, Bristow did not quibble, nor ask whether he accepted credit cards, nor even promise to drop the money in later, but drew out a real checkbook and a pen.
If, say, a quarter of it could be in cash, Strike added, chancing his luck,
and was staggered for the second time that morning when Bristow said, I did wonder whether you prefer, and counted out a pile of 50s in addition to the check. They emerged into the outer office at the very moment that Robin was about to enter with Strike's fresh coffee. Bristow's girlfriend stood up when the door opened and folded her newspaper with the air of one who had been kept waiting too long. She was almost as tall as Bristow, large-framed, with a surly expression and big, mannish hands. So, you've agreed to do it, have you? She asked Strike. He had the impression that she thought he was taking advantage of her rich boyfriend. Very possibly she was right.
Yes, John's hired me, he replied.
Oh well, she said ungraciously. You're pleased, I expect, John? The lawyer smiled at her, and she sighed and patted his arm, like a tolerant but slightly exasperated mother to a child. John Bristow raised his hand in a salute, then followed his girlfriend out of the room, and their footsteps clanged away down the metal stairs. Chapter 5 Strike turned to Robin, who had sat back down at the computer. His coffee was sitting beside the piles of neatly sorted mail lined up on the desk beside her.
Thanks, he said, taking a sip. And for the note. Why are you a temp?
What do you mean? She asked, looking suspicious.
You can spell and punctuate. You catch on quick. You show initiative. Where did the cups and the tray come from? The coffee and biscuits?
I borrowed them all from Mr. Crowdy. I told him we'd return them by lunchtime.
Mr. Who?
Mr. Crowdy, the man downstairs, the graphic designer.
And he just let you have them?
Yes, she said, a little defensively. I thought, having offered the client coffee, we ought to provide it. Her use of the plural pronoun was like a gentle pat to his morale.
"Well, that was efficiency way beyond anything temporary solutions have sent here before, take it from me. Sorry I kept calling you Sandra. She was the last girl. What's your real name?"
"Robin."
"Robin," he repeated. "That'll be easy to remember."
He had some notion of making a jocular allusion to Batman and his dependable sidekick, but the feeble jest died on his lips as her face turned brilliantly pink. Too late, he realized that the most unfortunate construction could be put on his innocent words. Robin swung the swivel chair back towards the computer monitor, so that all Strike could see was an edge of a flaming cheek. In one frozen moment of mutual mortification, the room seemed to have shrunk to the size of a telephone kiosk.
"I'm going to nip out for a bit," said Strike, putting down his virtually untouched coffee and moving crabwise towards the door, taking down the overcoat hanging beside it. "If anyone calls..."
"Mr. Strike, before you go, I think you ought to see this."
Still flushed, Robin took from on top of the pile of opened letters beside her computer a sheet of bright pink writing paper and a matching envelope, both of which she had put into a clear plastic pocket. Strike noticed her engagement ring as she held the things up.
"It's a death threat," she said.
"Oh, yeah," said Strike. "Nothing to worry about. They come in about once a week.
But..."
"It's a disgruntled ex-client, bit unhinged. He thinks he's throwing me off the scent by using that paper."
"Surely, though, shouldn't the police see it?"
"Give him a laugh, you mean?"
"It isn't funny, it's a death threat," she said.
And Strike realized why she had placed it, with its envelope in the plastic pocket. He was mildly touched.
"Just file it with the others," he said, pointing towards the filing cabinets in the corner. "If he was going to kill me, he'd have made his move before now. You'll find 6 months' worth of letters in there somewhere. Will you be all right to hold the fort for a bit while I'm out?"
"I'll cope,"
she said, and he was amused by the sour note in her voice, and her obvious disappointment that nobody was going to fingerprint the bekitten death threat.
"If you need me, my mobile number's on the cards in the top drawer."
"Fine,"
she said, looking at neither the drawer nor him.
"If you want to go out for lunch, feel free. There's a spare key in the desk somewhere."
"Okay.
See you later, then."
He paused just outside the glass door, on the threshold of the tiny dank bathroom. The pressure in his guts was becoming painful, but he felt that her efficiency and her impersonal concern for his safety entitled her to some consideration. Resolving to wait until he reached the pub, Strike headed down the stairs. Out in the street, he lit a cigarette, turned left, and proceeded past the closed 12-bar cafe, up the narrow walkway of Denmark Place, past a window full of multicoloured guitars and walls covered in fluttering flyers, away from the relentless pounding of the pneumatic drill. Skirting the rubble and wreckage of the street at the foot of Centrepoint, he marched past a gigantic gold statue of Freddie Mercury, stood over the entrance of the Dominion Theatre across the road, head bowed, one fist raised in the air, like some pagan god of chaos. The ornate Victorian face of the Tottenham pub rose up behind the rubble and roadworks, and Strike, pleasurably aware of the large amount of cash in his pocket, pushed his way through its doors, into a serene Victorian atmosphere of gleaming scroll dark wood and brass fittings. Its frosted glass half-partitions, its aged leather banquettes, its bar mirrors covered in gilt, cherubs and horns of plenty, spoke of a confident and ordered world that was in satisfying contrast to the ruined street. Strike ordered a pint of Doom Bar and took it to the back of the almost deserted pub, where he placed his glass on a high circular table, under the garish glass cupola in the ceiling, and headed straight into the gents, which smelled strongly of piss. 10 minutes later, and feeling considerably more comfortable, Strike was a third of the way into his pint, which was deepening the anaesthetic effect of his exhaustion. The Cornish beer tasted of home, peace and long-gone security. There was a large and blurry painting of a Victorian maiden dancing with roses in her hands, directly opposite him. Frolicking coyly as she gazed at him through a shower of petals, her enormous breasts draped in white, she was as unlike a real woman as the table on which his pint rested, or the obese man with the ponytail who was working the pumps at the bar. And now, Strike's thoughts swarmed back to Charlotte, who was indubitably real, beautiful, dangerous as a cornered vixen, clever, sometimes funny, and in the words of Strike's very oldest friend, fucked to the core. Was it over? Really over this time? Cocooned in his tiredness, Strike recalled the scenes of last night and this morning. Finally, she had done something he could not forgive, and the pain would, no doubt, be excruciating once the anaesthetic wore off. But in the meantime, there were certain practicalities to be faced. It had been Charlotte's flat that they had been living in, her stylish, expensive maisonette in Holland Park Avenue, which meant that he was, as of 2 o'clock that morning, voluntarily homeless.
"Bluey, just move in with me. For God's sake, you know it makes sense. You can save money while you're building up the business, and I can look after you. You shouldn't be on your own while you're recuperating, Bluey. Don't be silly."
Nobody would ever call him Bluey again. Bluey was dead. It was the first time in their long and turbulent relationship that he had walked out. 3 times previously, it had been Charlotte who had called a halt. There had been an unspoken awareness between them, always, that if ever he left, if ever he decided he had had enough, the parting would be of an entirely different order to all those she had instigated, none of which, painful and messy though they had been, had ever felt definitive. Charlotte would not rest until she had hurt him as badly as she could in retaliation. This morning's scene, when she had tracked him to his office, had doubtless been a mere foretaste of what would unfold in the months, even years, to come. He had never known anyone with such an appetite for revenge. Strike limped to the bar, secured a second pint, and returned to the table for further gloomy reflection. Walking out on Charlotte had left him on the brink of true destitution. He was so deeply in debt that all that stood between him and a sleeping bag in a doorway was John Bristow. Indeed, if Gillespie called in the loan that had formed the down payment on Strike's office, Strike would have no alternative but to sleep rough.
"I'm just calling to check how things are going, Mr. Strike, because this month's instalment still hasn't arrived. Can we expect it within the next few days?"
And finally, since he had started looking at the inadequacies of his life, why not make a comprehensive survey? There was his recent weight gain. A full stone and a half, so that he not only felt fat and unfit, but was putting unnecessary additional strain on the prosthetic lower leg he was now resting on the brass bar beneath the table. Strike was developing the shadow of a limp purely because the additional load was causing some chafing. The long walk across London in the small hours, kit bag over his shoulder, had not helped. Knowing that he was heading into penury, he had been determined to travel there in the cheapest fashion. He returned to the bar to buy a third pint. Back at his table beneath a cupola, he drew out his mobile phone and called a friend in the Metropolitan Police, whose friendship, though of only a few years' duration, had been forged under exceptional conditions. Just as Charlotte was the only person to call him Bluey, so Detective Inspector Richard Anstis was the only person to call Strike Mystic Bob, which name he bellowed at the sound of his friend's voice.
"Looking for a favour," Strike told Anstis. "Name it. Who handled the Lula Landry case?"
While Anstis searched out their numbers, he asked after Strike's business, right leg, and fiancé. Strike lied about the status of all three.
"Glad to hear it," said Anstis cheerfully. "Okay, here's Wardle's number. He's all right, loves himself, but you'll be better off with him than Carver. He's a cunt. I can put in a word with Wardle. I'll ring him right now for you if you like."
Strike tweaked a tourist leaflet from a wooden display on the wall and copied down Wardle's number in the space beside a picture of the horse guards.
"When are you coming over?" Anstice asked. Bring Charlotte one night. Yeah, that'd be great. I'll give you a ring. Got a lot on just now.
After hanging up, Strike sat deep in thought for a while, then called an acquaintance much older than Anstice, whose life path had run in a roughly opposite direction.
"Calling in a favour, mate," said Strike. "Need some information."
"On what?"
"You tell me. I need something I can use for leverage with a copper."
The conversation ran to 25 minutes, and involved many pauses, which grew longer and more pregnant, until finally Strike was given an approximate address and two names, which he also copied down beside the horse guards, and a warning, which he did not write down, but took in the spirit in which he knew it was intended. The conversation ended on a friendly note, and Strike, now yawning widely, dialed Wardle's number, which was answered almost immediately by a loud, curt voice.
"Wardle!" "Yeah, hello. My name's Cormoran Strike, and..."
"You what?"
"Cormoran Strike," said Strike, "is my name."
"Oh, yeah," said Wardle. "Anstice just rang. You're the private dick. Anstice said you were interested in talking about Lula Landry."
"Yeah, I am," said Strike again, suppressing another yawn as he examined the painted panels on the ceiling,
bacchanalian revels that became, as he looked, a feast of fairies. Midsummer Night's Dream, a man with a donkey's head.
"But what I really like is the file."
Wardle laughed.
"You didn't save my fucking life, mate."
"Got some information you might be interested in. Thought we could do an exchange."
There was a short pause.
"I take it you don't want to do this exchange over the phone?"
"That's right," said Strike.
"Is there anywhere you like to have a pint after our day's work?"
Having jotted down the name of a pub near Scotland Yard, and agreed that a week today, failing any nearer date, would suit him too, Strike rang off. It had not always been thus. A couple of years ago he had been able to command the compliance of witnesses and suspects. He had been like Wardle, a man whose time had more value than most of those with whom he consorted, and who could choose when, where, and how long interviews would be. Like Wardle, he had needed no uniform. He had been constantly cloaked in officialdom and prestige. Now, he was a limping man in a creased shirt, trading on old acquaintances, trying to do deals with policemen who would once have been glad to take his calls.
"Arsehole," said Strike aloud, into his echoing glass.
The third pint had slid down so easily that there was barely an inch left. His mobile rang. Glancing at the screen, he saw his office number. No doubt Robin was trying to tell him that Peter Gillespie was after money. He let her go straight to voicemail, drained his glass, and left. The street was bright and cold, the pavement damp, and the puddles intermittently silver as clouds scudded across the sun. Strike lit another cigarette outside the front door, and stood smoking it in the doorway of the Tottenham, watching the workmen as they moved around the pit in the road. Cigarette finished, he ambled off down Oxford Street to kill time until the temporary solution had left, and he could sleep in peace. Chapter 6 Robin had waited 10 minutes to make sure that Strike was not about to come back, before making several delightful telephone calls from her mobile phone. The news of her engagement was received by her friends with either squeals of excitement or envious comments, which gave Robin equal pleasure. At lunchtime, she awarded herself an hour off, bought 3 bridal magazines and a packet of replacement biscuits, which put the petty cash box, a labelled shortbread tin, into her debt to the tune of 42 pence, and returned to the empty office, where she spent a happy 40 minutes examining bouquets and bridal gowns, and tingling all over with excitement. When her self-appointed lunch hour was over, Robin washed and returned Mr. Crowdy's cups and tray and his biscuits. Noting how eagerly he attempted to detain her in conversation on her second appearance, his eyes wandering distractedly from her mouth to her breasts, she resolved to avoid him for the rest of the week. Still, Strike did not return.
For want of anything else to do, Robin neatened the contents of her desk drawers, disposing of what she recognised as the accumulated waste of other temporaries. 2 squares of dusty milk chocolate, a bald emery board, and many pieces of paper carrying anonymous telephone numbers and doodles. There was a box of old-fashioned metal acro clips, which she had never come across before, and a considerable number of small, blank, blue notebooks, which, though unmarked, had an air of officialdom. Robin, experienced in the world of offices, had the feeling that they might have been pinched from an institutional store cupboard. The office telephone rang occasionally. Her new boss seemed to be a person of many names. One man asked for Oggy, another for Monkey Boy, while a dry, clipped voice asked that Mr. Strike return Mr. Peter Gillespie's call as soon as possible. On each occasion, Robin contacted Strike's mobile phone and reached only his voicemail. She therefore left verbal messages, wrote down each caller's name and number on a post-it note, took it into Strike's office, and stuck it neatly on his desk. The pneumatic drill rumbled on and on outside. Around 2 o'clock, the ceiling began to creak as the occupant of the flat overhead became more active. Otherwise, Robin might have been alone in the whole building. Gradually, solitude, coupled with the feeling of pure delight that threatened to burst her ribcage every time her eyes fell on the ring on her left hand, emboldened her. She began to clean and tidy the tiny room under her interim control. In spite of its general shabbiness and an overlying grubbiness, Robin soon discovered a firm organisational structure that pleased her own neat and orderly nature. The brown card folders, oddly old-fashioned in these days of neon plastic, lined up on the shelves behind her desk, were arranged in date order, each with a handwritten serial number on the spine. She opened one of them, and saw that the acro clips had been used to secure loose leaves of paper into each file. Much of the material inside was in a deceptive, difficult-to-read hand. Perhaps this was how the police worked. Perhaps Strike was an ex-policeman. Robin discovered the stack of pink death threats to which Strike had alluded in the middle drawer of the filing cabinet, beside a slim sheaf of confidentiality agreements. She took one of these out and read it, a simple form, requesting that the signatory refrain from discussing, outside hours, any of the names or information they might be privy to during their working day. Robin pondered for a moment, then carefully signed and dated one of the documents, carried it through to Strike's inner office, and placed it on his desk, so that he might add his name on the dotted line supplied. Taking this one-sided vow of secrecy gave back to her some of the mystique, even glamour, that she had imagined lay beyond the engraved glass door, before it had flown open and Strike had nearly bowled her down the stairwell. It was after placing the form on Strike's desk that she spotted the kit bag stuffed away in a corner behind the filing cabinet. The edge of his dirty shirt, an alarm clock, and a soap bag peeked from between the open teeth of the bag zip. Robin closed the door between inner and outer offices as though she had accidentally witnessed something embarrassing in private. She added together the dark-haired beauty fleeing the building that morning, Strike's various injuries, and what seemed, in retrospect, to have been a slightly delayed but determined pursuit. In her new and joyful condition of betrothal, Robin was disposed to feel desperately sorry for anyone with a less fortunate love life than her own. If desperate pity could describe the exquisite pleasure she actually felt at the thought of her own comparative paradise. At 5 o'clock, and in the continuing absence of her temporary boss, Robin decided that she was free to go home. She hummed to herself as she filled in her own timesheet, bursting into song as she buttoned up her trench coat. Then she locked the office door, slid the spare key back through the letterbox, and proceeded, with some caution, back down the metal stairs, towards Matthew, and home. Chapter 7 Strike had spent the early afternoon at the University of London Union Building, where, by dint of walking determinedly past reception with a slight scowl on his face,
He had gained the showers without being challenged or asked for his student card. He had then eaten a stale ham roll and a bar of chocolate in the cafe. After that, he had wandered, blank-eyed in his tiredness, smoking between the cheap shops he visited to buy, with Bristow's cash, the few necessities he needed now that bed and board were gone. Early evening found him holed up in an Italian restaurant, several large boxes propped up at the back beside the bar, and spinning out his beer until he had half forgotten why he was killing time. It was nearly 8 before he returned to the office. This was the hour when he found London most lovable. The working day over, her pub windows were warm and jewel-like, her streets thrummed with life, and the indefatigable permanence of her aged buildings, softened by the streetlights, became strangely reassuring. "We have seen plenty like you," they seemed to murmur soothingly, as he limped along Oxford Street, carrying a boxed-up camp bed. 7.5 million hearts were beating in close proximity in this heaving old city, and many, after all, would be aching far worse than his. Walking wearily past closing shops, while the heavens turned indigo above him, Strike found solace in vastness and anonymity. It was some feat to force the camp bed up the metal stairwell to the second floor, and by the time he reached the entrance bearing his name, the pain in the end of his right leg was excruciating. He leaned for a moment, bearing all his weight on his left foot, panting against the glass door, watching it mist.
"You fat cunt," he said aloud. "You knackered old dinosaur."
Wiping the sweat off his forehead, he unlocked the door and heaved his various purchases over the threshold. In the inner office, he pushed his desk aside and set up the bed, unrolled the sleeping bag, and filled his cheap kettle at the sink outside the glass door. His dinner was still in a pot noodle, which he had chosen because it reminded him of the fare he used to carry in his ration pack. Some deep-rooted association between quickly heated and rehydrated food and makeshift dwelling places had made him reach automatically for the thing. When the kettle had boiled, he added the water to the tub and ate the rehydrated pasta with a plastic fork he had taken from the Yulu Cafe, sitting in his office chair, looking down into the almost deserted street, the traffic rumbling past in the twilight at the end of the road, and listening to the determined thud of a bass from 2 floors below in the 12-bar cafe. He had slept in worse places. There had been the stone floor of a multi-story car park in Angola, and the bombed-out metal factory where they had erected tents and woken coughing up black soot in the mornings. And worst of all, the dank dormitory of the commune in Norfolk, to which his mother had dragged him and one of his half-sisters when they were 8 and 6, respectively. He remembered the comfortless ease of hospital beds in which he had lain for months, and various squats, also with his mother, and the freezing woods in which he had camped on army exercises. However basic and uninviting the camp bed looked lying under the one naked light bulb, it was luxurious compared with all of them. The act of shopping for what he needed, and of setting up the bare necessities for himself, had lulled Strike back into the familiar soldierly state of doing what needed to be done, without question or complaint. He disposed of the pot noodle tub, turned on the lamp, and sat himself down at the desk where Robin had spent most of the day. As he assembled the raw components of a new file, the hardback folder, the blank paper, and an acro clip, the notebook in which he had recorded Bristow's interview, the pamphlet from the Tottenham, Bristow's card, he noticed the new tidiness of the drawers, the lack of dust on the computer monitor, the absence of empty cups and debris, and a faint smell of pledge. Mildly intrigued, he opened the petty cash tin, and saw there, in Robin's neat, rounded writing, the note that he owed her 42 pence for chocolate biscuits. Strike pulled 40 of the pounds Bristow had given him from his wallet and deposited them in the tin. Then, as an afterthought, counted out 42 pence in coins and laid it on top. Next, with one of the biros Robin had assembled neatly in the top drawer, Strike began to write, fluently and rapidly, beginning with the date.
The notes of Bristow's interview he tore out and attached separately to the file. The actions he had taken thus far, including calls to Anstis and to Wardle, were noted, their numbers preserved. But the details of his other friend, the provider of useful names and addresses, were not put on file. Finally, Strike gave his new case a serial number, which he wrote, along with the legend, Sudden Death, Lula Landry, on the spine, before stowing the file in its place at the far right of the shelf. Now, at last, he opened the envelope which, according to Bristow, contained those vital clues that police had missed. The lawyer's handwriting, neat and fluid, sloped backwards in densely written lines. As Bristow had promised, the contents dealt mostly with the actions of a man whom he called the Runner. The Runner was a tall black man, whose face was concealed by a scarf and who appeared on the footage of a camera on a late-night bus which ran from Islington towards the West End. He had boarded this bus around 50 minutes before Lula Landry died. He was next seen on CCTV footage taken in Mayfair, walking in the direction of Landry's house at 1:39 a.m. He had paused on camera and appeared to consult a piece of paper. Pos an address or directions? Bristow had added helpfully in his notes, before walking out of sight. Footage taken from the same CCTV camera shortly after showed the Runner sprinting back past the camera at 2:12 and out of sight. Second black man also running. Pos look out? Disturbed in car theft? Car alarm went off around the corner at this time, Bristow had written. Finally, there was CCTV footage of a black man closely resembling the Runner walking along a road close to Gray's Inn Square, several miles away, later in the morning of Landry's death. Face still concealed, Bristow had written. Strike paused to rub his eyes, wincing because he had forgotten that one of them was bruised. He was now in that light-headed, twitchy state that signified true exhaustion. With a long, grunting sigh, he considered Bristow's notes, with one hairy fist holding a pen, ready to make his own annotations. Bristow might interpret the law with dispassion and objectivity in the office that had provided him with his smart engraved business card. But the contents of this envelope merely confirmed Strike's view that his client's personal life was dominated by an unjustifiable obsession. Whatever the origin of Bristow's preoccupation with the Runner, whether because he nursed a secret fear of that urban bogeyman, the criminal black male, or for some other, deeper, more personal reason, it was unthinkable that the police had not investigated the Runner and his, possibly lookout, possibly car thief, companion, and certain that they had had good reason for excluding him from suspicion. Yawning widely, Strike turned to the second page of Bristow's notes. At 1:45, Derek Wilson, the security guard on duty at the desk overnight, felt unwell and went into the back bathroom, where he remained for approximately a quarter of an hour. For 15 minutes prior to Lula's death, therefore, the lobby of her building was deserted, and anybody could have entered and exited without being seen. Wilson only came out of the bathroom after Lula fell, when he heard Tansy Bestigui screaming. This window of opportunity tallies exactly with the time the Runner would have reached 18 Kentigern Gardens if he passed the security camera on the junction of Alderbrook and Bellamy Roads at 1:39. "And how," murmured Strike, massaging his forehead, "did he see through the front door to know the guard was in the bog?" "I have spoken to Derek Wilson, who is happy to be interviewed." "And I bet you paid him to do it," Strike thought, noting the security guard's telephone number beneath these concluding words. He laid down the pen with which he had been intending to add his own notes and clipped Bristow's jottings into the file. Then he turned off the desk lamp and limped out to pee in the toilet on the landing. After brushing his teeth over the cracked basin, he locked the glass door, set his alarm clock, and undressed. By the neon glow of the street lamp outside, Strike undid the straps of his prosthetic, easing it from the aching stump, removing the gel liner that had become an inadequate cushion against pain. He laid the false leg beside his recharging mobile phone, manoeuvred himself into his sleeping bag, and lay with his hands behind his head, staring up at the ceiling. Now, as he had feared, the leaden fatigue of the body was not enough to still the misfiring mind. The old infection was active again, tormenting him, dragging at him. What would she be doing now? Yesterday evening, in a parallel universe, he had lived in a beautiful apartment in a most desirable part of London, with a woman who made every man who laid eyes on her treat Strike with a kind of incredulous envy.
"Why don't you just move in with me? Oh, for God's sake, Bluey, doesn't it make sense? Why not?"
He had known from the very first that it was a mistake. They had tried it before, and each time it had been more calamitous than the last.
"We're engaged, for God's sake. Why won't you live with me?"
She had said things that were supposed to be proofs that, in the process of almost losing him forever, she had been as irrevocably changed as he had, with his 1.5 legs.
"I don't need a ring. Don't be ridiculous, Bluey. You need all your money for the new business."
He closed his eyes. There could be no going back from this morning. She had lied once too often, about something too serious. But he went over it all again, like a sum he had long since solved, afraid he had made some elementary mistake. Painstakingly, he added together the constantly shifting dates, the refusal to check with chemist or doctor, the fury with which she had countered any request for clarification, and then the sudden announcement that it was over, with never a shred of proof that it had been real. Along with every other suspicious circumstance, there was his hard-won knowledge of her mythomania, her need to provoke, to taunt, to test.
"Don't you dare fucking investigate me! Don't you dare treat me like some drugged-up squaddy! I'm not a fucking case to be solved! You're supposed to love me, and you won't take my word even on this!"
But the lies she told were woven into the fabric of her being, her life. So that to live with her and love her was to become slowly enmeshed by them, to wrestle her for the truth, to struggle to maintain a foothold on reality. How could it have happened that he, who from his most extreme youth had needed to investigate, to know for sure, to winkle the truth out of the smallest conundrums, could have fallen in love so hard and for so long with a girl who spun lies as easily as other women breathed?
"It's over," he told himself. "It had to happen."
But he had not wanted to tell Anstis, and he could not face telling anyone else. Not yet. There were friends all over London who would welcome him eagerly to their homes, who would throw open their guest rooms and their fridges, eager to condole and to help. The price of all of those comfortable beds and home-cooked meals, however, would be to sit at kitchen tables once the clean pyjamaed children were in bed, and relive the filthy final battle with Charlotte, submitting to the outraged sympathy and pity of his friends' girlfriends and wives. To this, he preferred grim solitude, a pot noodle, and a sleeping bag. He could still feel the missing foot, ripped from his leg 2.5 years before. It was there, under the sleeping bag. He could flex the vanished toes if he wanted to. Exhausted as Strike was, it took a while for him to fall asleep. And when he did, Charlotte wove in and out of every dream, gorgeous, vituperative, and haunted. Part 2. Non ignara mali miseris succarere disco. No stranger to trouble myself, I am learning to care for the unhappy. Virgil, Aeneid, Book 1. Chapter 1. With all the gallons of newsprint and hours of televised talk that have been poured forth on the subject of Lula Landry's death, rarely has the question been asked, why do we care? She was beautiful, of course, and beautiful girls have been helping to shift newspapers ever since Dana Gibson cross-hatched, lazy-lidded sirens for the New Yorker.
She was black, too. Or rather, a delicious shade of café au lait, and this, we were constantly told, represented progression within an industry concerned merely with surfaces. I am dubious. Could it not be that this season café au lait was the in shade? Have we seen a sudden influx of black women into the industry in Landry's wake? Have our notions of female beauty been revolutionised by her success? Are black Barbies now outselling white? The family and friends of the flesh and blood Landry will be distraught, of course, and have my profound sympathy. We, however, the reading-watching public, have no personal grief to justify our excesses. Young women die every day in tragic, which is to say unnatural, circumstances, in car crashes from overdoses and occasionally because they attempted to starve themselves into conformity with the body shape sported by Landry and her ilk. Do we spare any of these dead girls more than a passing thought as we turn the page and obscure their ordinary faces? Robin paused to take a sip of coffee and clear her throat.
So far, so sanctimonious, muttered Strike.
He was sitting at the end of Robin's desk, pasting photographs into an open folder, numbering each one, and writing a description of the subject of each in an index at the back. Robin continued where she had left off, reading from her computer monitor. Our disproportionate interest, even grief, bears examination. Right up until the moment that Landry took a fatal dive, it is a fair bet that tens of thousands of women would have changed places with her. Sobbing young girls laid flowers beneath the balcony of Landry's £4.5 million penthouse flat after her crushed body was cleared away. Has even one aspiring model been deterred in her pursuit of tabloid fame by the rise and brutal fall of Lula Landry?
Get on with it, said Strike. Her, not you, he added hastily. It's a woman writing, right?
Yes, Melanie Telford, said Robin, scrolling back to the top of the screen to reveal the headshot of a jowly middle-aged blonde. Do you want me to skip the rest?
No, no, keep going.
Robin cleared her throat once more and continued. The answer, surely, is no. That's the bit about aspiring models being deterred.
Yeah, got that.
Right, well, 100 years after Emmeline Pankhurst, a generation of pubescent females seeks nothing better than to be reduced to the status of a cut-out paper doll, a flat avatar whose fictionalized adventures mask such disturbance and distress that she threw herself from a third-story window. Appearance is all. The designer, Guy Sommet, was quick to inform the press that she jumped wearing one of his dresses, which sold out in the 24 hours after her death. What better advert could there be than that Lula Landry chose to meet her maker in Sommet? No, it is not the young woman whose loss we bemoan, for she was no more real to most of us than the Gibson girls who dripped from Dana's pen. What we mourn is the physical image flickering across a multitude of red tops and celeb mags, an image that sold us clothes and handbags and a notion of celebrity that, in her demise, proved to be empty and transient as a soap bubble. What we actually miss, were we honest enough to admit it, are the entertaining antics of that paper-thin good-time girl whose stripped cartoon existence of drug abuse, riotous living, fancy clothes and dangerous on-off boyfriend we can no longer enjoy. Landry's funeral was covered as lavishly as any celebrity wedding in the tawdry magazines who feed on the famous and whose publishers will surely mourn her demise longer than most. We were permitted glimpses of various celebrities in tears, but her family were given the tiniest picture of all. They were a surprisingly unphotogenic lot, you see. Yet the account of one mourner genuinely touched me. In response to the inquiry of a man who she may not have realised was a reporter, she revealed that she had met Landry at a treatment facility and that they had become friends. She had taken her place in a rear pew to say farewell and slipped as quietly away again. She has not sold her story, unlike so many others who consorted with Landry in life. It may tell us something touching about the real Lula Landry, that she inspired genuine affection in an ordinary girl. As for the rest of us...
Doesn't she give this ordinary girl from the treatment facility a name? Interrupted Strike.
Robin scanned the story silently. No. Strike scratched his imperfectly shaven chin.
Bristow didn't mention any friend from a treatment facility.
Do you think she could be important? Asked Robin eagerly, turning in her swivel chair to look at him.
It could be interesting to talk to someone who knew Landry from therapy instead of nightclubs.
Strike had only asked Robin to look up Landry's connections on the internet because he had nothing else for her to do. She had already telephoned Derek Wilson, the security guard, and arranged a meeting with Strike on Friday morning at the Phoenix Cafe in Brixton. The day's post had comprised two circulars and a final demand. There had been no calls, and she had already organised everything in the office that could be alphabetised, stacked or arranged according to type and colour. Inspired by her Google proficiency of the previous day, therefore, he had set her this fairly pointless task. For the past hour or so, she had been reading out odd snippets and articles about Landry and her associates, while Strike put into order a stack of receipts, telephone bills and photographs relating to his only other current case. "Shall I see whether I can find out more about that girl, then?" asked Robin.
"Yeah," said Strike absently, examining a photograph of a stocky, balding man in a suit and a very ripe-looking redhead in tight jeans.
The besuited man was Mr. Geoffrey Hook. The redhead, however, bore no resemblance to Mrs. Hook, who, prior to Bristow's arrival in his office, had been Strike's only client. Strike stuck the photograph into Mrs. Hook's file and labelled it number 12, while Robin turned back to the computer. For a few moments there was silence, except for the flick of photographs and the tapping of Robin's short nails against the keys. The door into the inner office behind Strike was closed to conceal the camp bed and other signs of habitation, and the air was heavy with the scent of artificial limes due to Strike's liberal use of cheap air freshener before Robin had arrived. Lest she perceive any tinge of sexual interest in his decision to sit at the other end of her desk, he had pretended to notice her engagement ring for the first time before sitting down, then made polite, studiously impersonal conversation about her fiancé for 5 minutes. He learned that he was a newly qualified accountant called Matthew, that it was to live with Matthew that Robin had moved to London from Yorkshire the previous month, and that the temping was a stopgap measure before finding a permanent job. "Do you think she could be in one of these pictures?" Robin asked after a while. "The girl from the treatment centre." She had brought up a screen full of identically sized photographs, each showing one or more people dressed in dark clothes, all heading from left to right, making for the funeral. Crash barriers and the blurred faces of a crowd formed the backdrop to each picture. Most striking of all was the picture of a very tall, pale girl with golden hair drawn back into a ponytail, on whose head was perched a confection of black net and feathers. Strike recognised her, because everyone knew who she was. Kiara Porter, the model with whom Lula had spent much of her last day on Earth, the friend with whom Landry had been photographed for one of the most famous shots of her career. Porter looked beautiful and sombre as she walked towards Lula's funeral service. She seemed to have attended alone because there was no disembodied hand supporting her thin arm or resting on her long back. Next to Porter's picture was that of a couple captioned film producer Freddie Bestigui and wife Tansy. Bestigui was built like a bull, with short legs, a broad-barreled chest, and a thick neck. His hair was grey and brush-cut, his face a crumpled mass of folds, bags and moles, out of which his fleshy nose protruded like a tumour. Nevertheless, he cut an imposing figure in his expensive black overcoat, with his skeletal young wife on his arm. Almost nothing could be discerned of Tansy's true appearance behind the upturned fur of her coat collar and the enormous round sunglasses. Last in this top row of photographs was Guy Sommet, fashion designer. He was a thin black man who was wearing a midnight blue frock coat of exaggerated cut. His face was bowed and his expression indiscernible due to the way the light fell on his dark head, though three large diamond earrings in the lobe facing the camera had caught the flashes and glittered like stars. Like Porter, he appeared to have arrived unaccompanied, although a small group of mourners, unworthy of their own legends, had been captured within the frame of his picture. Strike drew his chair nearer to the screen, though still keeping more than an arm's length between himself and Robin. One of the unidentified faces, half severed by the edge of the picture, was John Bristow, recognisable by the short upper lip and the hamsterish teeth. He had his arm around a stricken-looking older woman with white hair. Her face was gaunt and ghastly, the nakedness of her grief touching. Behind this pair was a tall, haughty-looking man, who gave the impression of deploring the surroundings in which he found himself. "I can't see anyone who might be this ordinary girl," said Robin, moving the screen down to scrutinise more pictures of famous and beautiful people looking sad and serious. "Oh, look! Evan Duffield!" He was dressed in a black T-shirt, black jeans, and a military-style black overcoat. His hair, too, was black. His face all sharp planes and hollows. Icy blue eyes stared directly into the camera lens. Though taller than both of them, he looked fragile compared to the companions flanking him. A large man in a suit, and an anxious-looking older woman, whose mouth was open and who was making a gesture as though to clear a path ahead of them. The threesome reminded Strike of parents steering a sick child away from a party. Strike noticed that, in spite of Duffield's air of disorientation and distress, he had made a good job of applying his eyeliner.
"Look at those flowers."
Duffield slid up into the top of the screen and vanished. Robin had paused on the photograph of an enormous wreath in the shape of what Strike took initially to be a heart, before realising it represented two curved angel wings composed of white roses. An inset photograph showed a close-up of the attached card.
"Rest in peace, Angel Lula, D.B. Mack," Robin read aloud. "D.B. Mack, the rapper? So they knew each other, did they?"
"No, I don't think so. But there was that whole thing about him renting a flat in her building. She'd been mentioned in a couple of his songs, hadn't she? The press were all excited about him staying there."
"You're well informed on the subject."
"Oh, you know, just magazines," said Robin vaguely, scrolling back through the funeral photographs.
"What kind of name is D.B.?"
Strike wondered aloud.
"It comes from his initials. It's D.B., really," she enunciated clearly. "His real name's Darryl Brandon MacDonald."
"A rap fan, are you?"
"No," said Robin, still intent on the screen. "I just remember things like that."
She clicked off the images she was perusing and began tapping away on the keyboard again. Strike returned to his photographs. The next showed Mr. Geoffrey Hook kissing his ginger-haired companion, hand palpating one large canvas-covered buttock outside Ealing Broadway tube station.
"Here's a bit of film on YouTube, look," said Robin. "D.B. Mack talking about Lula after she died."
"Let's see it," said Strike,
rolling his chair forwards a couple of feet, and then, on second thoughts, back one. The grainy little video, 3 inches by 4, jerked into life. A large black man wearing some kind of hooded top, with a fist picked out in studs on the chest, sat in a black leather chair, facing an unseen interviewer. His hair was closely shaven, and he wore sunglasses.
"Lula Landry's suicide," said the interviewer, who was English.
"That was fucked up, man. That was fucked up," replied D.B.,
running his hand over his smooth head. His voice was soft, deep and hoarse, with the very faintest trace of a lisp.
"That's what they do to success. They hunt you down, they tear you down. That's what envy does, my friend. The motherfucking press chased her out that window. Let her rest in peace, I say. She's getting peace right now."
"Pretty shocking welcome to London for you," said the interviewer. "With her, you know, like falling past your window." D.B. Mack did not answer at once. He sat very still, staring at the interviewer through his opaque lenses. Then he said,
"I wasn't there. Or you got someone who says I was?
The interviewer's yelp of nervous, hastily stifled laughter jarred.
God, no, not at all, not...